Cultural anthropologist Carol Delaney discusses her book, Abraham on Trial, The Social Legacy of Biblical Myth. Dr. Delaney explores the roots of patriarchy by asking the question, what gave Abraham the right to sacrifice, or murder, Isaac? What is the legacy of this myth on the way we regard children today? And Brené Brown is the author of Daring Greatly, How the Courage to be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. Dr. Brené Brown has done research on topics no one wants to discuss, shame and vulnerability. Yet it's through these human experiences that we find the courage to dare greatly and become wholehearted. She's been featured on TED, The Power of Vulnerability, and Listening to Shame. In this candid conversation, she weaves her own experience with her research and thus inspires us all to live courageous lives. From the archives of Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net, I'm John Schack. Stay with us. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network, and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm, and click donate. For the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit. ProgressiveSpirit.net. I'm John Schuck. In this episode, I take us back to 2012 for a rebroadcast of interviews with Brené Brown and Carol Delaney. In the first part of today's show, you'll hear an interview that first aired in March 2012 with cultural anthropologist Dr. Carol Delaney. Dr. Delaney is the author of Abraham on Trial, The Social Legacy of Biblical Myth, a book that you wrote in the late 1990s, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. I think it came out in 1998 the first time.
And this book is about the biblical figure of Abraham. And to kind of catch listeners up, I want to tell them how I got connected with Dr. Delaney. I did a series of sermons on the myths of Genesis at my congregation this past fall, and I put the texts of my sermons on my blog, shuckandjive.org, and somehow a text of it got into Dr. Delaney's email, and because it had to do with Abraham. And so Dr. Delaney sent me an email back, and in this you said, I agree with a lot of what you say. You're talking to me about patriarchy, gender, fathers, and sons, except toward the end when I feel you whiffle out of the implications. As an anthropologist, I do not believe these are pan-human definitions, but constructed in specific cultures. And so I was talking about the stories of Genesis as kind of universal human stories, and you said, no, they're more particular and specific than that. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. I think different cultures have very different myths, and not all myths are myths of creation. Not all origin myths are myths of creation, but the one that we have is a myth of creation. And if there's creation, there has to be a creator. And so also these myths assume certain ideas about gender, about relationships, about ideas about the divine. That are not universal. And I think, therefore, we need to look at each culture and the myths that seem to influence them. And the biblical myths, particularly Genesis, has been extraordinarily influential, not just for religious people, but for our culture, for Western culture as a whole.
And so the reason that it appears to be universal is because it's so dominant. Is that right?
I think so, yeah.
And so the myths of, but they are particular. And what is particular about them in regards to patriarchy, for example?
Well, they are particular, but of course they're very widespread because Western culture has been a huge influence for, you know, 1,000 years and more. And there are other cultures that perhaps might be male dominant, but patriarchy is different. Patriarchy means the power of the father. And therefore, when I started looking at these things, I started to think about what was presupposed by the story of Abraham, rather than just starting from the interpretations of the story. I wanted to know what it was based on, what kinds of ideas about gender particularly underpinned it. And that's where I sort of continued my investigation.
And your investigation led you to see that that patriarchy has a particular theory of procreation to it. Is that right? The seed and the ground as a metaphor for, well, where babies come from. I found
that's
that.
Right. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, for a long time, I have been very disturbed about the Abraham story, right from when I was a child. And this is going back a little bit, if that's okay. But I was sent to the local school, which was a Catholic school, even though I'm not Catholic. And the first time I heard about it, it was in the third grade, and I was furious. I said, what kind of God is that? I don't want that kind of God. And then the story kind of went underground until I had a child myself and began thinking about that story. And that's when I entered Harvard Divinity School and realized that you have to look at the language. And the language of that story is all about Abraham's seed. So what did that mean? And I started to think that, you know, back in those days, people had no idea about genes and ovum and all that stuff, but rather they had a very particular theory of procreation. And it was the male seed that was creating the child, basically. And the woman was seen as the ground, certainly nurturing, but it did not give the identity. And it was the seed that passed along through males from father to son and on, and it did not go through daughters. And so even though I was at the divinity school at a time when there was a lot of feminist critique of the biblical stories, many of them just wanted to change the language. And I said, no, because that will totally mask the patriarchal underpinnings of this whole religious system. So I was against changing the language from seed, say, to offspring or seed to children, because that's not what was meant. It was definitely about the dominance of fathers.
And the idea of that the seed of the father really is implanted in the womb, which is like ground, so the ground doesn't provide any identity to the seed or any, or even to claim any power or relationship, in a sense.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
So that's how Abraham can get away in our story in Genesis with deciding to go and or obeying God the Father, who tells him to sacrifice his only son, which is actually he had another one too. But anyway, in the case of the story, without having to get Sarah's permission.
Yes, I think that's right. And it also then is the way we think. I mean, first of all, the name Abraham means exalted father, or the father is exalted. And so there's the establishment within that story of the whole notion of not only of fatherhood, but also of God as a father, at least as a male. And that he is the one who created the world as fathers create children. And I think there's an analogy there going on between both that level and the human level. So I think the story, even though Genesis begins with creation, I think it's this story and this idea about procreation that establishes that whole idea.
And that whole idea that the male
creativity.
And the male God, creativity, really has control and power over the seed or the offspring.
Right.
So Abraham can think that he's sacrificing, in a sense, killing, really, his own child, that it's his to kill.
Yes, of course, it belongs to him in that theory of procreation. And one of the reasons that I feel that I can sort of back this up is when I did my field work, I think you know, in a Turkish village. And the same theory of procreation, of course, exists in Islam as in Judaism. And the people there who are uneducated, they did not know about more modern theory of procreation, still talked in terms of seed. And yes, the father had absolute authority in the household, and the children belonged to him, and they talked about it that way.
I'm speaking with Dr. Carol Delaney, a cultural anthropologist, author of the book Abraham on Trial, The Social Legacy of Biblical Myth. This is Religion for Life. The Abraham on Trial, what is the significance of that title?
Well, there have been books written and stories about the trials of Abraham, that apparently there were 10 trials about leaving his home country and other kinds of trials that he went through. And so I kind of turned it a little bit and wanted to make a play on that word and put him on trial, and why we have not really, investigated this story a bit more and what does it mean. Because he is the model of faith, precisely because he's willing to go through with it. He's not the one who said, stop. He's the model of faith because he was willing to go through with it. And I think
he's the model of faith because he was willing to obey this voice, God, to go and kill your child. And it does. Obviously, Abraham has a parallel within Christianity. We think of the verse of John 3:16, in which God sent his only beloved son, so to speak. So that myth also carried over into the Christian mythology.
Yes, I think so. I think the Christian theology is based, or takes its cue from the Abraham story. What Abraham didn't do, God did.
And, of course, the subtitle of your book is The Social Legacy of Biblical Myth, meaning that these stories have effects in the way we treat children. You begin your book by talking about a trial in California in which a man killed his child and said God told him to do it. Can you tell us about that trial?
Yes. In fact, I've always been thinking of writing a book about Abraham and the story of Abraham, but then all of a sudden, one day, I saw the newspaper about this trial that was going, or the man who had sacrificed, he said, his child because God told him to. And I just decided I had to go and attend the trial and interview everybody. And at first, I thought of writing a whole book about the trial. And then decided it would be one chapter in the bigger book. But it was fascinating. I mean, everybody, of course, knew about the Abraham story and made allusions to it. But some of the people later, when I talked to them, said, well, God would never ask somebody to do something against scripture. In other words, because the scripture now has said that, not to do that. On the other hand, one of the other people said, but how do you know the mind of God? And that's exactly what the man who sacrificed his child, said that he believed that he had heard the word of God and that he went through with it.
So what happened in that trial? What happened to the man?
Well, he was accused of murder because there is no, obviously in a secular legal system, there's no term for sacrifice, but he was accused of murder. But he was also then thought to be insane. And so he's been committed to an insane asylum. And several times he came up for probation, and several times he has been denied. And I attended a couple of those sessions as well.
So what is the difference then between that man who is insane and accused of murder and Abraham?
Exactly. I think that is the question. And I think people need to question the biblical story that we, put up on a pedestal, as I think you have indicated, because it's still about being willing to do it. And here's where I think there's the whole, what I call the God loop. You have to love God more than your children or more than your fellow beings. Whereas I feel that what would be godly is to love your children and your fellow beings rather than first being willing to sacrifice everything for God. I think it should show up through our relationships rather than holding up this image, basically, that we have, and which we fight. Other people will hold up different images rather than trying to instill some way of having this love of fellow beings be the model. I don't think we get to it by first loving God first and being willing to sacrifice for that.
I'm speaking with Dr. Carol Delaney, cultural anthropologist, author of Abraham on Trial, The Social Legacy of Biblical Myth. And we're talking about the story of Abraham and its social effects. Now, some people might say that we're reading too much into this story, that the people who originally read this story or have been telling this story weren't really talking about literally sacrificing their children. It's a symbol. It's a myth. You're supposed to take the faith aspect, the spiritual idea of it, that he's giving up what's most important to him. What do you think about those explanations?
I think they're silly. I think I just talked about that a little bit, that it can't just be, the whole idea of faith that based on this story that he is willing to sacrifice his child as the model of faith, that's not the kind of faith I would want. Also people, many of the traditional interpretations are that this story put an end to child sacrifice. Well, there's no evidence that child sacrifice was being, committed during those early times. And the only evidence, and it's certainly not unequivocal, came more than 1,000 years later than the Abraham story. And there's nothing about child sacrifice before that story. So I think those kinds of views, let's just take it on faith, are silly. And I think they have very dangerous implications. And I think we started to talk about the social legacy. One of it is, of course, patriarchy and the ways in which women have been thought about and treated. But the other ways are the ways we sacrifice children even today. And I think I talked about that a bit, as sometimes it's the sacrifice of innocence, the sexual abuse that's been going on, and even by priests who are supposed to be there to protect children. It's scandalous. And there's abuse of children, there's murder of children. I think I gave statistics that a child, every 14 hours, a child under 5 is murdered, and teenagers every few hours. I mean, what kind of culture is this that we allow this kind of thing? And war, where we send off our sons and daughters now too to sacrifice for the country. I think these are kinds of ideas that I would like to see changed.
And these ideas, you would say, come from this story of Abraham, or stories like it, or this story in particular?
I think you can't say that there's a direct connection back to the story, but the more I investigated it, the more I think about its ramifications, even into a secular culture. Certain values about the value of sacrifice. And yet it's never self-sacrifice. It's always we sacrifice our sons and daughters to go off, for instance, in war. And we also sacrifice their innocence with the sexual abuse and mutilation and murders of children. And I think the other thing I talked about was welfare. And when these fathers who have planted their seed, escape and leave them, and then we castigate the single mothers and their children instead of protecting them and helping them. So I think there's been a lot of ramifications. The other thing, of course, is in marriage and what marriage is supposed to be, and about women taking their husband's name so they disappear. There's a lot of implications, and I can't say that there's a direct connection, but it is a faith that has been predominant in the West for 2,000 years.
And that faith has to do with the sense of the believer of just trust and obey, having to do with the father power or patriarchy, of the willingness to just take it on faith, to go ahead and believe, and to, in a sense, be a vessel. I was thinking now that over Christmas, talking about the virgin birth and the whole idea that theory can only happen in this idea of patriarchy with the seed in the womb, in which Mary contributes nothing, but the seed or the word or Christ or God is implanted in her. And so she becomes then a model of faith, and the model is that she contributes nothing of herself to her life, but is simply a vessel for an other to take control. And I was thinking about that in terms of a lack of responsibility for our choices. I'm just a vessel, and God does everything. seems to be like that spirituality has taken a number of different forms in terms of not taking responsibility for our actions.
I think that's a really good analysis, and I totally agree with you. The other thing about the virgin birth, and well, Chris, getting back to Christmas, I remember when I was at the divinity school, I sent a Christmas card around saying, every birth is a miracle. And I think that's what the original message might have been. And yet theologians are the ones who have constructed it into this, you know, huge edifice and with the meanings that it has come to have. But in fact, I think every birth is a miracle. And maybe if we started thinking of that rather than just one birth was a miracle, things might begin to change as well.
I'm speaking with Dr. Carol Delaney, who is a professor emerita at Stanford University. She's currently a research scholar at Brown, and she has written a book called Abraham on Trial, The Social Legacy of Biblical Myth, challenging the Abraham story and saying we ought to look at this story critically. And that is very difficult in many cases for people even to begin to look at the Bible critically, to even consider things such as the Abraham story as a myth in and of itself. But you're suggesting not only just to regard it as a myth, but also regard it as a myth that may be harmful for our health as a society, our health in regards to the way we treat children, the way we treat women. You mentioned that there were some, that this idea of procreation in a patriarchal way, of the seed being planted in the ground, wasn't the only pre-modern or isn't the only pre-scientific way of understanding procreation, that there are some other theories. What are some of those?
Well, that was wonderful when I was decided to become an anthropologist, because I found out that there were other cultures that most people don't really know about that have very different ideas of how human beings come into existence. And one of the most different, the most different one is among the Australian native peoples of Australia, whose traditional myths are that children are the reincarnation of maternal, or I shouldn't even say maternal because that means mother, but of the female's ancestors. And that the father, in intercourse, is only feeding this child-to-be. So a very different theory, and they have very different social ideas, very different kinship systems, very different ways of thinking about relationships, very different values. There are also Native American tribes who have had different ideas about procreation. And I think, again, some of them are not about creation. It's about coming into being or reincarnations of various ancestors, whether from the male side or the female side. But there are definitely, and there have been, cultures that have had very different ideas about this. Unfortunately, of course, Western culture has become so dominant and widespread that many of those are disappearing, and they also don't want to appear as ignorant. So I think that is one of the reasons we probably don't hear about so many of these different systems. But that really helped me in anthropology to study various kinship systems and how people thought about relationships. And not all of them think about or have even terms mother and father, because those terms are related to a very specific theory of procreation. They have very different terms for thinking about their relationships.
I wonder if the modern scientific understanding of procreation might actually be helpful, in which men and women contribute equally. Understanding that in a mythical or symbolic or religious sense might be a helpful corrective to this patriarchal notion of procreation that we still carry with us, perhaps unconsciously, in the way that we regard whose children belong to whom and so forth.
I totally agree. I think that's one of the things I would like to see. But as you know, myths die very hard, and so does the language. But yes, I think it would be terrific if we could start to think creatively about how to symbolize the fact that both men and women contribute to the creation of a child. Of course, women do even more. Not only do they provide half of the genetic input. They also gestate the child and give birth to the child, and most often nurture it after it's born. So we need to rethink some of the ways we talk about procreation and changing the language in that respect, yes. Biblical language, I think, should stay the way it is because it shows exactly how patriarchal the whole system is.
My guest has been Dr. Carol Delaney, cultural anthropologist, professor at Stanford University, professor emerita, currently a research scholar at Brown University, author of Abraham on Trial, The Social Legacy of Biblical Myth. Dr. Delaney, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking with you.
You've been listening to a 2012 interview with Carol Delaney, author of Abraham on Trial, The Social Legacy of Biblical Myth. You're listening to Progressive Spirit. I'm John Shuck. An interview with Brené Brown is next. Stay with us. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen, and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Shuck. In December 2012, I broadcast an interview with Brené Brown. Dr. Brené Brown has done research on topics no one really wants to discuss: shame and vulnerability. Yet it is through these human experiences that we find the courage to dare greatly and become wholehearted. She's been featured on TED, The Power of Vulnerability, and Listening to Shame. She's the author of the #1 New York Times bestseller, Daring Greatly. We're going to discuss that today. In this candid conversation, she weaves her own experience with her research and thus inspires us all to live courageous lives.
It's a vulnerable story, actually. Right after the TED talk had gone viral, I was feeling incredibly exposed. I was having a really hard time. And one of the things that really dawned on me, and kind of dawned on is not the right word because that sounds nice, kind of struck me and hit me in a hard way, was that I think even though, you know, I was excited about my research and passionate about what I was finding and wanted to get it out with the world, to the world, the truth was that I was really had engineered my career to stay right under the radar out of fear of criticism and out of fear of everything that comes with being too much in the public eye. And so I kind of lost control of that with the TED talk. And so one day when I was feeling particularly discouraged and had, you know, made the huge mistake of reading some anonymous comments on like the CNN site or something where I'd written something. Mm-hmm. And they were just mean-spirited. I mean, they weren't constructive feedback. They were just kind of crappy comments. Yeah. About me and appearance and all kinds of stuff. And so I sent my kids off to school. My husband left for work, and I sat down and I just numbed myself completely without like 8 hours of Downton Abbey. And after it was over, I got on my computer and I started kind of looking around, reading about England during that time. And I Googled Theodore Roosevelt because I wanted to see if he was president at the time Downton Abbey was happening. And I came across this incredible quote that like literally changed my life. Can I just read a very short passage to you?
Please, please do it. Yes.
Yeah. So what I read was, "It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly." And when I read that, I mean, I literally just started crying and I thought, you know what? This is who I want to be. I want to be in the arena. I want to be all in my life and my work and my family. And I want to take chances and I want to, you know, show up. And mm-hmm. And that's the first thing that hit me. And then the second thing that hit me about that quote was, it represented everything I've ever learned in a decade of studying vulnerability.
Hmm.
That vulnerability is not winning, it's not losing, it's showing up and being seen. And with that comes great moments and really hard moments. But I think the thing that's consistent is the most meaningful moments of our lives happen when we're being authentic and real.
So you had that TED Talk in 2010. And
yeah.
then you had this experience with reading this Teddy Roosevelt quote. So there's a sense in which you had been doing all of this study on vulnerability and shame, and then it kind of hit you personally. Is that right?
It kicked me in the butt would be a better way to say it,
okay.
Yes.
All right.
I used to say, up until about really a year ago, when I wrote about it or I talked about it in an interview, I used to say that my data drugged me screaming and kicking to this new way of being. But now I think I would say it saved me. It did drag me kicking and screaming. Don't get me wrong, because I don't do vulnerability naturally. Which is why I'm a researcher and armored up in a lot of different ways in my life. But I think it's really hard to do this work and not think about how it affects your own life.
Yeah, because of course, with academic and research, you are supposed to, right, be behind the screen, and you're analyzing something else. And then, in your case, and when we're talking about obviously something that affects us at the deep human level, it you can't help but also be drawn into it.
The research became very personal, and there was a very definitive moment for me in 2006 when I was coding some data, and I spent the first 6 years really heavily just trying to understand shame. What is this thing? What is that emotion that we all know that makes us feel not good enough? Like, where does it come from? How do we deal with it? Why do we have it? And so in 2006, I had all this data and all these interviews, and I realized, man, embedded in all these stories of shame were stories of resilience, were stories of, people like me who wake up, in this deep culture of scarcity, of never good enough, perfect enough, extraordinary enough, rich enough, beautiful enough, everything we're not enough of. There were people who I'd interviewed along the way who, when they woke up in the morning, it's not that they lived in a vacuum or somewhere different than us. They made different choices. They woke up and said, you know what? Yeah, it's scary. I feel uncertain. I feel vulnerable, but I'm enough. And so I wanted to know what they had in common. And as I started looking and answering those questions, it became very personal, because what I realized is I was, I called these folks the wholehearted, because what they reminded me of were people who were just living and loving with their whole hearts, like they were all in. And so everything that the wholehearted were, trying to move away from were the things that defined my life at the time: perfectionism, judgment, comparison, productivity as self-worth, what will people think? And so it became very personal on that day and every day since.
And that's the day that you talk about was your breakdown / spiritual awakening. Is that the positive reframing of that?
Yeah, no, I really actually put the data away. I called some friends and said, I need a therapist. I think I need a therapist. And I was like, not anyone too touchy-feely. And I went to see a therapist who really only saw mental health professionals and people who are trained in, in my work, not my work, but in, psychology, social work. And I actually took a syllabus with me that I had created, like in Excel, about what I wanted to work on based on the research and how long I was willing to spend on it. And somewhere in that period of time with her, which of course my spreadsheet lasted all about 20 seconds, I said, I think I'm having a breakdown. I think this is a breakdown. I'm falling apart here. And Diana was her name, or is her name. She's not a therapist anymore. She retired after me. If that's but she said, well, you can call it a breakdown, but I see it more of as a spiritual awakening. And then she said something really interesting. I said, maybe you can't. I said, why does it feel like a breakdown? And she said, I'm not sure that you can have one without the other. So it was a really important and great and hard time in my life where it was kind of research or heal thyself a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I'm doing a series of sermons at my church using Matthew Fox, the theologian, and he's talking about the four paths of creation spirituality, and one is the way of letting go and letting be, the via negativa. And I was thinking as I was reading your work that being vulnerable is really part of that. It's that letting go of all of those things that give us our identity and control, our spreadsheets, our perfectionism, and it's going to a place that we don't have any parameters for. And we really do have to allow ourselves to kind of fall or sink into a vulnerability. And it is scary. It is like a breakdown, and it's also like a spiritual awakening.
It is. I think it's, you know, what's interesting is in doing the research, I went back out and I asked thousands of people, what is vulnerability to you? You know, what is going, you know, what does it mean to you? What are your experiences of it? And people said things that were so... You know, because I think like a lot of people, I had the idea that vulnerability was weakness. And I knew in my own life that didn't feel true. I knew that being vulnerable was the most courageous and brave thing I'd ever tried doing. And I've done some pretty typically brave things. But when I asked people, they said things like, vulnerability is my first date after my divorce. Hmm. Vulnerability is sitting with my wife who has stage 4 breast cancer and trying to make plans for our children. Vulnerability is trying to get pregnant after my second miscarriage. Vulnerability is negotiating a raise. It's, you know, getting excited, enthusiastic for my son who is trying out for orchestra and really wants to make first chair, sending him off to school with a hug and my best wishes and knowing that's not going to happen. You know, that vulnerability is... To me, there's no equation where being vulnerable equals being weak. I think, in fact, the vulnerability is our most accurate measure of courage. It is, it's truth. It's, you know, I had a man once tell me that it's like standing on a very sharp edge and your choices are to fall back to what you know that won't move you forward, but it at least is what you know, or to fall forward into what you don't know, where hope and possibility live, you know? And I think it is, it's so scary, but you know what? I have to say this, I have to add this. It is scary and it's terrifying at times, but I don't think it's anywhere as scary and terrifying as spending your life on the outside of the arena, wondering what if I would have shown up? What if I would have said I love you first? You know, what if?
Right. All those regrets of what if. My guest is Dr. Brené Brown. She's the author of Daring Greatly, How the Courage to Be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. Now, some folks, if you're just joining us, this is a Religion for Life. Some folks listening to this program might say, yeah, I want to be vulnerable, but what happens if it doesn't work out? What do you do? How do you give people the inspiration to go ahead and take a jump? What is that makes people do it?
Well, there are a couple of things that I think people who are practicing vulnerability, embracing it, have in common. I think the first thing is, and this was definitely true as I set out on this kind of spiritual adventure for me. And I say spiritual adventure because one of the things people have in common that are doing this is a real clarity about their values and what's important to them. And, you know, kind of the lens through which they see their lives. And for me, you know, I think if you're going to, you know, using Teddy Roosevelt's metaphor of the arena, I think if you're going to go into the arena, the one thing you better bring with you is absolute clarity about what's important to you. Because if you're going to show up and you're going to be vulnerable and take risks, you're going to get your butt kicked. I mean, you're going to get pushed around. There's no question. I mean, it doesn't work out every time. I mean, if I'm going to really try something new in my work, sometimes it's going to work out, it's going to be awesome, and sometimes it's going to be terrible. But the value that I hold on to in those moments is that courage is a value that's really important to me. Being clear about being in service of my work and not always playing it safe because that's not in service of my work. And so I think the one thing that you have to get clear on, or we all have to get clear on, are our values. I want to be a courageous person. And if you want to be a courageous person, you have to be vulnerable.
So how do you develop a sense of who to be vulnerable with what? I mean, you were vulnerable with 6 million people on your TED Talk, but you weren't vulnerable about everything you are, I'm sure. What are ways we can develop a sense of what to reveal to whom and when?
Right. I think there's a real sacredness about vulnerability. And my kind of what I've learned from the research participants is you share your story with people who've earned the right to hear them. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to remember that vulnerability, you know, there are four myths of vulnerability. The first is that it's weakness. The second is that we can opt out of doing vulnerability, that I can say, nice topic, I don't do vulnerability. You know, to be alive is to be vulnerable. Vulnerability is simply uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. We experience it every day, all day. To be in relationship is vulnerable. To be in work is, you know, leadership is vulnerable. The third myth is that vulnerability is letting it all hang out. And so when I say, you know, we trust our stories with people who've earned the right to hear them, I think it's important to remember that vulnerability is ultimately about trust, intimacy, and connection. So vulnerability without boundaries is not vulnerability at all. You know, like you said, I did share, you know, some vulnerability with, you know, when I did the TED Talk, which ultimately, you know, 6 million plus people have seen. But there wasn't a story that I shared in that talk that I had not already shared with people really close to me, thought about, processed through, got comfortable with, owned in a, you know, in a way that I felt like I could share.
Okay.
It's just really important that we share with people with whom we have relationships that can bear the weight of our story.
So developing those relationships is so important. You know, I was thinking recently as I was reading your book about the idea of letting go of those ideas that people have about us, or letting go of those, you know, worrying about what people think, to be our authentic self and having our own voice. And then I thought, yeah, but I don't want to lose my relationships with others. I don't want to lose that sense of I do care about what people think. Is there a balance there with that tension too?
Absolutely. You know, like I think – when I, you know, I think when I hear people say, I don't care what anyone thinks, which is usually filled with a lot of cuss words, a big red flag goes up for me, because when, you know, here's the tightrope. When we stop caring what people think, we lose our capacity for connection. When we are defined by what people think, we lose our willingness to be vulnerable. And so it becomes a tightrope walk, you know, and I think the thing that balances us, it's different for all of us. For me, you know, when you picture, you know, the flying Walindas or somebody walking across those tightropes, they always have the balance bar in their hand, you know, and to me, that bar is shame resilience. It's understanding what triggers me and what makes me feel small. And it's also my faith, which goes back to the values. Like, and so I try to maintain that balance of I want to be open and connected to people. So I do care what people think, but I also want to have the courage to be myself and be real. So I don't want to be defined by it.
My guest is Brené Brown, author of Daring Greatly, How the Courage to be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. You can find information about her books and her work on her website, BrenéBrown.com. Let's move to this discussion of this other topic that nobody wants to talk about, including myself, shame. What is that, and how do we manage that?
You know, I'll give you the quick 1-2-3s that I always share with people because I think it's very helpful. The 1-2-3s of shame are, we all have it. Number one, It's the most primitive human emotion that we experience. We have about 40, 50 years of data now that show us the only people who don't experience shame are people who don't have any capacity for empathy or connection. So we've all got it. It's that warm wash that comes over us and makes us feel small and less than. Number two, nobody wants to talk about it. And number three, the less we talk about it, the more we have it. You know, shame, I call shame, you know, I refer to shame as the gremlins, which, because, you know, I'm crazy about a good metaphor, if you can't tell by now. but, you know, the shame gremlins drive two tapes, you know, not good enough, and who do you think you are? So when we want to be vulnerable, when we want to raise our hand at a meeting and say, everyone's excited about this idea or this new project. And, what you really want to say is, I understand everyone's excited. I think we need to be careful. But shame is that gremlin that whispers in your ear, hey, you're the only one in here without an MBA. Keep your mouth shut. Or you're not smart enough. Or what will people think? And so shame keeps us small. And I think one helpful way to think about shame is that we're hardwired for connection, neurobiologically, physically, emotionally, I would argue spiritually, hardwired for connection. Shame is the fear of disconnection. It's the fear that there's something about me, something I've done or something that's happened to me or I haven't done that makes me unworthy of love and belonging. And, we can't live without love and belonging. In the absence of love and belonging, there's always suffering. And so shame is that fear. And so what I studied and still look at is if we can't get rid of shame, how do we move through it in a constructive way so that we can, and what I found is that men and women with high levels of what I call shame resilience have four things in common. The first is they recognize shame. They know when they're in it. They know what triggered it. They kind of reality check some of those crazy expectations and messages that fuel shame. Like we're supposed to be perfect and, be all knowing and have it together. They reach out, tell their story. That's what they have in common. And the biggest part of that is kind of this counterintuitive, we need to tell our shame stories with people who've, again, earned the right to hear them.
Yeah, and you've really modeled that in your book and in your talks. You talk about how you felt, like when you first did that TED Talk, and you felt after you did it, you said you kind of had a vulnerability hangover or something? I think that's what you said. Yeah, and so you modeled being able to feel that, and rather than to go into defensive mode, to talk about it and use it as a teaching moment.
Yeah, I mean, one of the stories that I tell in Daring Greatly is, someone emailed me and asked me to speak at an event. And I get a lot of great offers, which I'm really grateful for, but I only accept about 10, 15% of them because I have young kids and I'm trying to live wholehearted, not just talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so I emailed back and said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I have a family commitment. And he emailed, which was very hard for me because one of my gremlins is, it's not one, I have like a whole choir of gremlins that say, don't disappoint anyone, don't let anyone down, kind of that whole be everything for everybody. And so I emailed back and said, I can't do that. And he emailed back and said, you're not wholehearted at all. You're super selfish, just kind of this crappy email. And so I immediately went into shame. And when we go into shame, we're really not fit for human consumption. I mean, some of the worst things that we've ever done to our children, our students, our employees, our partners, we've done when we've been in shame. And so I have a mantra, which is don't talk, text, or email anyone when you're in shame. Like I have to get back on my emotional feet like all of us do. But I didn't listen to myself. And so I forwarded the email to my husband and I wrote this really terrible thing about this guy, like, what a jerk, but it was super colorful, PG-13 email. Mm-hmm. And I hit reply instead of forward. Mm. So it goes back to this guy. And so, immediately I'm in shame. I mean, and one of the interesting things that men and women with high levels of resilience have in common is they physically recognize when they're in shame. And so I knew I was in shame. My heart was racing. My mouth got dry. I went into tunnel vision, time slowed down. And so shame resilience is, about my first thing that I do is talk to myself like I talk to someone I love. So instead of beating myself up and God, I'm so stupid. I can't believe I did that. I'm an idiot. Trying to talk to myself as if I was talking to Ellen or Charlie, my kids, hey, it's okay. You're imperfect. We all make mistakes. And then we really have to reach out and share that story because shame craves silence.
Okay. Yeah.
We have to share it. And when shame is met with empathy, it kind of dies on the vine. So I called my husband and a really good friend. I told them what was happening. They were able to kind of talk me through it and love me anyway. And I was able to email back, apologize, and set some boundaries about kind of future communications. And so shame resilience is really about moving through those hard moments constructively.
Yeah, so it's not about not experiencing shame. We all do. But it's really knowing what it is and knowing the signs of it and responding in a positive way as we can.
Well said. That's exactly it.
You know, I'm thinking of my guest, Dr. Brené Brown, thinking of the last 2 years for you. You've been quite a whirlwind. You've been on TED twice. Your talks have been watched over 6 million times. You've just published a number one New York Times bestseller, Daring Greatly. You're a highly sought after speaker. You've published curriculum on the topic of shame to help other counseling professionals with this work. You even have T-shirts. Can I ask you to be vulnerable one more time here? What does it feel like to be in the spotlight and successful and famous? Do you still have that inner gremlin that says you're not good enough after all this?
Oh my God, yes. Yeah, of course. But the truth is, I'm kind of an introverted person. I'm actually a very introverted person. And I'm the most fueled and the most juiced up when I'm home with my husband and my two kids and, you know, we're playing cards or just hanging out. And that just hasn't changed. That's when I feel most in my skin, probably. And so, yeah, it's been a very hard, very fun, very difficult, and very weird.
Well, you know, when you talk about this work, I just think that you've truly hit on something big. I mean, all the behaviors that we have, from rage to perfectionism to cruelty to addiction, are all go back to shame. And I'm wondering, do you think it's just the tip of the iceberg, that there's much more to learn about shame and vulnerability?
The only thing I really wanted to do with my entire career was to start a conversation, a national conversation, about shame and vulnerability. And I think that's happening. I think we're just beginning. I think we want to be brave, and I think we want our lives. I think we want more joy, and I think we want more transparency and authenticity. So I do think we're at a tipping point, and I think it's bigger than, of course, my work. I think it's about the human spirit.
Dr. Brené Brown, my guest. She is the author of Daring Greatly, How the Courage to Be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. A final question, Dr. Brown. If you could put your insights and your message and your passion and what you've learned into a 30-second commercial, what would your commercial say?
Show up and be seen. We're looking not for who you think you're supposed to be, but who you are. We need you.
Dr. Brené Brown, my guest on Religion for Life. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a special encore presentation of Progressive Spirit, featuring interviews from 2012 when the show was called Religion for Life. Catch over 300 interviews with scholars, activists, and authors who have something to say about social justice, spirituality, human flourishing, and things that matter on progressivespirit.net. For the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and KBOO in Portland, Oregon, I'm John Schuck. Be well. Thank you.